It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check in with the Discover magazine editor about this month's top stories from the world of science.
First, around the world, someone dies of an alcohol-related death every 10 seconds. That's 3.3 million deaths annually, according to a new report out today from the World Health Organization on the health risks of alcohol consumption.
While addiction is oftentimes the biggest concern, when assessing the risks of alcohol, there are about 200 diseases associated with alcohol consumption, including liver cirrhosis and some forms of cancer.
While the report looks at the problem globally, it is an issue in particular with relevance to Wisconsin. Here in Wisconsin, we have the highest rate of binge drinking, according to the Centers for Disease Control, and general alcohol consumption is 30% higher than the rest of the country.
The economic cost here in Wisconsin comes out to about $6.9 billion a year, according to a recent study from the UW Population Health Institute. Here with us to discuss the public health impact of our heavy alcohol consumption is Maureen Buzalaki. She's Executive Director of Health First Wisconsin. Maureen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this was an international report. A global report shows about half of the world's population drinks alcohol, averaging about 17 liters of pure alcohol a year. Roughly how much do we consume here in Wisconsin by comparison?
Well, our consumption rate is above both the national and international averages. For binge drinking, we're at about 23% of the population. And I believe internationally it's 16. So, you know, major, you know, difference. And our annual alcohol consumption is about 28% higher than the national average.
What are some of the biggest health consequences we see related to alcohol here in the state?
Well, you know, obviously there's death that happens from a variety of things, between accidents, as well as, you mentioned, health conditions. There's a lot of hospitalizations related to alcohol. And I mean, not, you know, having a glass of wine with dinner. We're talking about excessive alcohol consumption. Of course, a lot of folks have to go to treatment. There's a lot of arrests that are associated with alcohol, and of course, motor vehicle crashes.
What kind of toll economically? We mentioned that dollar figure from the Population Health Institute. How big a problem is this for our state's economy?
I think it's a pretty big problem. We've got an estimated almost $3 billion in lost productivity. So folks who aren't able to perform their jobs or they become disabled or unable to do their jobs prematurely. There's another $2 billion dollars in premature deaths, about $750 million in health care, and then you've got, you know, the criminal justice system, motor vehicle, human services. So, you know, it definitely takes a toll. In terms of taxpayers, we pay about $2.9 billion due to excessive consumption of alcohol.
The World Health Organization in that report is looking for a 10% reduction in harmful alcohol use by 2025. I want to talk about some of the specific things you're looking for here in Wisconsin. And let's start with the binge drinking you mentioned earlier. We're well above the national average there. What do you see as the best ways to target binge drinking in the state?
Well, we have an environment here in Wisconsin that encourages people to overconsume. So if you look at how many alcohol outlets we have compared, you know, both nationally and internationally, we're way out of bounds in terms of the number of places you can buy alcohol and the number of places you can consume alcohol in. So that's certainly something that local communities can be looking at. We also think it would be important that we change our laws so that if you're under the age of 21, you can't drink in public. So you can't be drinking, you know, at the bar when mom and dad are buying, you know, alcohol. A lot of restaurants and bars don't do that anyway, but I think it's important to set the norm so that we're making sure we're setting sort of the culture that it's not okay for kids to drink.
On a related note, while I was driving around the state, I saw a lot of communities had signs just this weekend about parents hosting parties where teens drink. How important is that as part of the anti-health risks of alcohol effort?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know that certain seasons tend to, you know, we hate opening the paper and finding out that a carload of teenagers were killed because they were drinking at prom or graduation. And so a lot of communities have taken a concerted effort to make sure parents understand the risk. And I think almost 40 communities have passed laws that say if it's your property, you're also liable. So not only can you not supply alcohol to kids, especially kids not your own children, but that, you know, providing a place for them is also against the law. I think, you know, in Wisconsin, we have this sort of rite of passage, you know, everyone will be okay, we went through it. But I think the research has really shown that alcohol on a kid's brain is pretty dangerous. And we know in athletics that it takes quite a while for kids to have their brains actually return to normal after a binge drinking episode, which is why we find a lot of injuries on Mondays and Tuesdays after binge drinking on Saturdays.
With smoking, it seemed like a lot of the effort was concentrated among younger teens through high school, the idea being that if you can get them to not start smoking at that age, you're in good shape for the rest of their lives. Is there an age range that you're particularly targeting with the alcohol message?
Really, it's very similar. If you can keep alcohol out of a child's brain until they're 21, their chances of having an alcohol disorder go way, way, way down. And it has to do with the brain development. So it's important to keep that in mind as parents. And I think as we learn more and more about how alcohol impacts a child's brain, we, you know, will hopefully change our culture a bit so that we are supporting each other in that. And that, you know, teenagers are going to do risky things, but we need to do our best to prevent that and make it as safe as possible.
If you had a message for parents out there of kids in the tween through teen, maybe even into college age, what would that message be?
I think talk to your kids about this issue. I know it's a difficult kind of thing, but I think it's really important. And pay attention to what's happening in your community. We find that kids often mimic what their parents do. And, you know, it's important to make sure that they understand that it's really not okay to do the same things when they're under 21. There's really, there is a scientific reason why you have the age of 21 for drinking, because of the brain development. Now, granted, everyone's brain is a slightly different rate than that, but that's a great place to aim for.
Maureen, you and others have been sounding the alarm about binge drinking, drunken driving in Wisconsin for a while, and talking about our alcohol culture. Are people listening to the message? Are we starting to take this seriously?
I think a lot of folks are quite concerned about it. But I think there's a lot more that we can do. The legislature, you know, only passed one out of the 7 bills they were presented with this session. They didn't even really discuss sobriety checkpoints, which is known to be a great way to prevent drunk driving. So I think we have a long way to go in terms of taking it seriously on the state level. However, in the local communities, we're seeing a lot of change going on with athletic codes changing so that kids can't even be seen at parties where alcohol is served, to the social host ordinances, which I referred to earlier. And another piece is a number of communities are really looking at their alcohol density and trying to work through that, you know, maybe not every business needs to have an alcohol license to operate well in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there for now. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Maureen Buzalaki. She's Executive Director of Health First Wisconsin. The World Health Organization released a report today detailing that 3.3 million people around the world die annually from alcohol-related deaths. The June issue of Discover Magazine hits newsstands tomorrow, which means we have Gemma Tarlak back with us to preview some of the month's coolest science stories.
Gemma is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the top science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Always great to be talking to you.
Well, you cover this month a really fascinating story about a solar-powered plane. And it kind of seems like a tall order to power this highly complex machine, an airplane, via solar power. How does it work?
Well, the Solar Impulse 2, it's actually kind of the sequel to the original that they crossed the country with last year. This is going to be the first round-the-world flight, and they're testing it now for a 2015 flight. But basically, they worked on making it very, very light with a huge wingspan. For example, the wingspan is longer than a 747, and the plane weighs less than a Ford Expedition, which is a pretty impressive combo of stats. But it's also, it's really slow. A Greyhound could outrun it. It's got a top speed of about 40 miles an hour, and a Greyhound, I think, tops out around 45 miles an hour. So it's a combination of a super light machine, super light materials, super big long wingspan, and just kind of harnessing technology in a way that's never been attempted before.
Okay, the dumb question maybe that pops into my head right away is, you're flying around the world, you're up in the air, and the sun goes down or a cloud goes up. I assume they don't come immediately plummeting to the ground. Why not?
No, it would be a very, very short test flight they did last year if that were the case. No, they have all kinds of workarounds, and they're actually going to do the flight over a 3 to 4 month period in sort of short stages. And, you know, there'll be the two test pilots doing this. They are the first to say, no, this is not going to be the way commercial solar flight is going to work. This is just a prototype, just kind of proof of concept showing people that it can be done. And once they do it, they're going to work on designing something that's a little more, I would say, realistic as a mode of transportation. But it's so exciting to think, you know, the sun is there. Why not use it for energy?
So is that the ultimate goal, though, having a passenger plane with more than one person in it?
Well, I think that is the ultimate goal. Right now, they're just concerned about actually getting this thing off the ground and around the world without incident. Our writer covered this. She opens the story with this great description of how the wing, an early prototype of it, just kind of cracked under the pressure. And, you know, it's very much in its infant stages. And we'll see where it goes.
Well, another story you have this month, an interview with a molecular biologist. This blew my mind a little bit, who studies how bacteria can talk to each other, kind of an oh-no moment for humanity. What is bacterial communication? How do we know what they're saying to each other?
You know, I have to tell you, when our editor, one of the editors first brought this story up and we started talking about it, everybody, I think, in the room got a chill because it's like, wait, bacteria communicate and they plan actions? Oh, this is great. But yeah, it's, you know, it's something bacteria have been doing for 4 billion years. They communicate using chemical language. So they're not actually, you know, sidling up to each other and saying, hey, Bob, how you doing? They're actually, though, communicating through chemicals, through these three different molecules they've identified so far. There may be more, but they basically, they do something called quorum sensing. You know, if you have some random lone bacterium floating around your body, you're going to be okay. But if you have enough to obtain a quorum, they can actually decide to attack you in mass when they realize, hey, we've got enough of us to gang up on this host organism. And again, they do that through chemical signals between these molecules. What really blew my mind when we were talking about the story was that bacteria can actually identify each other within a species, and they can also communicate across species. So if you have, you know, a random bacterium of cholera floating around and it meets up with a random bacteria of E. coli, they can pretty much chemically say to each other, hey, I'm cholera. And the other one will be like, hey, I'm E. coli. Now, if that is not terrifying, I don't know what is.
That sounds like the worst party mixer ever in your body. I don't know. Like,
I've been to that party.
I join with Rob on this. This did kind of freak me out a little bit. So these bacteria can coordinate their actions. So I guess the idea being that they get a quorum and then suddenly they can instigate a disease in your body. So what are scientists going to do with this very freaky information now that we have it?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's when really the infection starts, when they achieve their quorum and they do something called auto-induce. And they do whatever naughty business they're going to do, whether it's attacking your body or, you know, not all bacteria are bad. Some of them are just like bioluminescent. So when they reach their quorum, they just glow, which is awful nice. But anyway, bacteria in general, they call this communication chatter. And what they're trying to do is basically shut them up to find ways of working with these molecules, sending out the chemical signals to shut them down. And maybe they send out the signal, but it's not understood. So the bacteria never realize that there are enough that they've achieved a quorum and could attack. There are all different ways that they're trying to shut them down, but it's basically shutting down the chat room.
And you mentioned bacteria have been doing this for 4 billion years or so. This is new to us and new to the world of science, isn't it?
Yeah, the field is only about 20 or 30 years, and it's really only, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years that they're actually identifying these molecules, zeroing in on how they communicate and also how they could potentially shut them down.
And that bioluminescent bacteria you mentioned, that was one of our first hints, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. This is actually way back in the 70s. They started to notice that just a couple of random bacteria floating in the petri dish didn't do anything, but once they achieved their quorum, boom, they all lit up. And that's really where the research started.
So just to put it into context, or to give us a silver lining on this parcel of what seems like it's sort of bad news, is what are some of the key diseases that could possibly be interrupted and halted if we figure out how to manipulate the bacteria quorum?
Well, the good/creepy thing is that all bacteria appear to have this ability to communicate. So any disease, any kind of infection that is bacterially induced, we have the potential, once we figure out how to shut them up, we have the potential to treat. The example the researcher Bonnie Bassler cited was Pseudomonas, which can be fatal, especially to someone with, say, cystic fibrosis. And if you can figure out a way to shut that down, chances are you're going to figure out a way to stop the chatter for a lot of other bacteria as well. It's pretty exciting.
Well, I'd like to be the first to welcome our new bacterial overlords. And I want to move on to one more story, though. And this one's a fun one, a new kind of soccer ball. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I love this story. There's this company in New York called Uncharted Play, and they came up with the Socket. It has two C's. And it is a soccer ball for all intents and purposes. Looks like a normal soccer ball. It's about 2 ounces heavier. But inside, it has this whole kinetic energy mechanism that every time you kick it, every time it flies through the air, it is generating energy that is stored internally. And then after you play for 30 minutes, you can plug in a lamp, plug in your cell phone to charge, and you get 3 hours of power. And they designed this specifically for kids in the developing world because, you know, a lot of they don't have access to electricity. So when it's time to do homework, if the sun is down, what are they going to do? So the idea is they take the ball out, they play with it, kick it around for a while, come back in, plug in their light, plug the light into the socket, and then they can do their homework. Or, you know, their parents can cook or whatever they need the electricity for. They can actually use it.
So is this technology that will be priced accessibly to people in the developing world?
Well, what they're doing right now, and this is the very early stages, it just came on the market, they're selling them in the developed world for about $100. But when you order it, every time you order it, they identify a child in a developing world country, and they put them on what they call a socket team. And once they get 5 kids, in other words, once one of us lucky folks in the developed world buys a socket, when you get 5 kids, they actually give them a socket ball. So right now, children in the developing world are not having to pay for them. And I think they're trying to keep that, obviously as accessible and as affordable as possible.
And they found, I gather, that in some countries, soccer is a boy sport, not in others, obviously. What do they do for girls in those countries?
Yeah, I love this. And they were doing their test trials of the early versions. They noticed the girls never were playing soccer, but they were jumping rope. So they designed something called the Pulse. It's a jump rope. It uses very similar technology. And again, every time the rope turns, it's generating energy that is stored. And then you just plug in your USB right into the jump rope handles, and you can, again, charge your phone, use a light, all different applications.
Now, as a soccer ball goes or a jump rope goes, are these actually decent, bits of play equipment? Can you play a decent game of soccer with the socket?
Yeah, in fact, the socket is actually rougher and tougher than a normal soccer ball that's just inflatable, because normal inflatable balls, they only last a few weeks and then they go to the landfill because you can't really repair them after a time. The socket is designed to last 3 years. It has a really tough outer shell that stands up to all the kicking and all the rough ground that a lot of these playing fields are on. And it's also designed to be repaired using super basic parts. So, if it's off in Africa or in India or somewhere and it breaks, they don't have to send it back to the manufacturer to get the super special part. They can just kind of jerry-rig it to work.
Gemma, did you get to play with either of these, the socket or the pulse?
No, I didn't. Oh. And I'm so mad about that.
Well, think of harnessing the energy of children. Talk about renewable. I mean, they have a lot of energy, in my experience. This is could be a good solution to a lot of problems.
It's a win-win situation, you know. The children get some exercise, get out in the fresh air, and then they have no excuse not to do their homework.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us, Gemma.
Always great. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. Based in Waukesha, she joins us each month with some of the coolest stories from the worlds of science and technology. It's Museum Week here in Wisconsin, from the world's largest collection of mustard at the Mustard Museum in Middleton to the world-famous Milwaukee Art Museum, designed by architect Santiago Calatrava. Wisconsin boasts just a really big variety of museums.
Today we're celebrating those museums, and we'd like to hear from you. What is your favorite museum in Wisconsin? Tell us a memory from a museum here in the state that you're particularly fond of, or maybe if you could create your own Wisconsin museum, what would it be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Here with us now is Sarah Capellis. She's Vice President of the Wisconsin Federation of Museums and Registrar at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, guys. This is great.
So what is Wisconsin Museum Week?
Well, Wisconsin Museum Week is an annual celebration where museums all across the state come together and host special events, tours. We might just invite you in to see an exhibit that we have going on. And it's a way that Wisconsin Federation of Museums can say thank you to all of our museums out there and all of the hard work they do.
So how long has Wisconsin Museum Week been going on?
This is the 10th annual year that the Wisconsin Federation of Museums has promoted and sponsored the event, and it's also in association with International Museum Day, which is sponsored by ICOM, and that has been around since 1977.
And is part of the goal to get Wisconsinites to recognize how many resources are out there in our museum world?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think people have a full understanding of how much museums contribute to our communities.
And give us a sense of, you know, how many museums there are in Wisconsin.
There are right around 350 museums in Wisconsin, and that
wow.
includes, yep, our corporate museums, all the way to our small local history museums.
That is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of shocking.
We can get into some of the broad stroke stuff a little more, but I want to get into some of your favorites. What are some around the state that, and I know asking you to pick just a couple of the 300 some isn't fair, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Can you hit us with a couple now?
Yeah, I think you're going to get me in trouble, but my absolute favorite museum is the Milwaukee Public Museum. That's where I went to school, and that's also where I fell in love with museums. As a kid, my dad would take me every year, and we'd go look at the dinosaur exhibit, and that made me want to become a curator.
I'm with you. That's also on my top five list. I went there as a child with my grandfather and my mother. Now I take my kids there,
mm-hmm.
and it's just a fantastic museum. I actually really like the streets of old world Wisconsin. So I don't know, you feel like you're there. It's
mm-hmm.
amazing how they do it.
I remember when I was little, pumping the water in
yeah.
that little fountain,
mm-hmm. and the rattlesnake button that you can
oh,
press
yeah.
upstairs.
Yep. Not everybody
little
knows
known
about
secret.
That, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many people have these stories. I didn't grow up in Wisconsin. My wife grew up in the Milwaukee area. Same story as you. She remembers going there as a kid. Now we take our kids there, and they love the same things we've been talking about, the old world Milwaukee streets, the rattlesnake. Can you take us off the beaten path, though, a museum that isn't as well-known as the Public Museum?
Another one of my favorites is the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. It's fantastic. They have an exhibit called AKA Houdini, and it's really interactive. And as a kid, you get to go and pretend like you're lifting a really heavy dumbbell, or you can break out of a cage.
That
sounds like
fun.
A lot going on there. So in terms of other children's museums, that's an exhibit that's geared toward kids. What else is especially good for children in the state?
There's an assortment of small history museums and activities. Most of the museums will have special activities and scavenger hunts. At the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, we have a scavenger hunt intended for kids around the fourth grade age. Also, the Madison Children's Museum is a hoot for kids big and small.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. As we kick off Museum Week here in Wisconsin, we're asking you to share your favorite museums, maybe your local one. Share your museum memories as well. 800-642-1234. We've got Tom in La Crosse to start us off. Tom, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your museum recommendation?
Great. Well, I really, really love a little bit of the new and a little bit of the old, the Discovery World in Milwaukee, and you can go on a, they have a wonderful model of a sailing ship there, and you can go outside the museum and go to the actual sailing ship, go to the schooner Dennis Sullivan, and do it for real, help raise the sails and steer the ship and do a real hands-on, not just for kids, but for adults and everyone. It's a fantastic experience.
Tom, thanks, Lev, for that suggestion. My favorite thing there is the gears exhibit. I don't know why, but they've got like 80 different types of gears, and you get to flip them back and forth. I've like spent a half hour just doing the little gears there.
Yeah, there's a lot in, you know, a relatively, I don't know, compact area. You think about the aquariums, and there's even a touchy-feely tank, whatever they're called, where you can touch, I think it's rays or something like that. Yeah. So just a broad section of Wisconsin discovery stuff going on there. And what about you? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What museum do you come back to over and over because it's such a pleasure, or maybe it's part of your memories growing up here in Wisconsin? Let us know.
Sarah, take us on a tour of your home turf, if you will. You work at the Veterans Museum here in Madison.
Yeah, it's a really special museum, and we can come together and tell veteran stories. Oftentimes, these stories are very difficult for the veterans to tell themselves. So it's a place where they can come together with their families and connect over the stuff and feel safe to share their experiences.
I imagine you see a lot of conversations started there.
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite things to see is we'll have occasionally a World War II veteran that will still come in, and in an event, he will shake the hand of an Iraq veteran and say, thank you for your service. It's amazing just the way these men share this experience. So for Museum Week at the Veterans Museum, you can come in and we're going to have kids making World War I era biplanes out of clothespins. You can also check out a couple new exhibits. We have a War on Terror exhibit, and then our Civil War exhibit is very cool.
So what other statewide events are taking place to celebrate Museum Week?
Well, we have activities from state museums throughout the state, but there isn't really anything that the state specifically does for us to sponsor the event. The Wisconsin Federation of Museums comes together to try to bring the museums together and collaborate for marketing purposes. So lots of museums all over the place, from Kenosha all the way up to Appleton, the La Crosse Children's Museum, are participating, but there's no big broader event.
But if we check with our local museums, they might have some special events or special things going on this week.
Oh, absolutely. We have 30 institutions that have signed on specifically to join with us, but it can be really hard with limited staff to sign on for an event. So definitely check with your local museums. We hope that people will participate even outside of the Wisconsin Federation.
And let's go to our callers now. We have Kevin joining us from Tomahawk. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. My favorite museum is the Shipwreck Museum up in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. It kind of submerges you, to say the pun, into the past history, and you feel like you're really there. And I believe they even have opportunities you can volunteer to go up and work on the shipwrecks out in the Great Lakes.
Oh, really? I have not heard about that one. That's a fascinating one. You said that was in Whitefish Bay?
Yes, very cool and very... It just takes you back in time, which museum's supposed to do, I guess, but it makes you feel really like you're there.
Right. Well, thank you so much for that suggestion. The Shipwreck Museum in Whitefish Bay, have you heard of that one?
I haven't. I'm going to have to check that out this week.
Well, I have to say along the same lines, there's one I particularly love. It's very small. It doesn't take a lot of time to go through it, but the Port Washington Lighthouse Museum, I feel a little bit like we just heard that caller talking about. You feel like you're there, and they have a CD player playing the sound of waves in the background, and you've got scenes from maritime, you know, lore of Wisconsin everywhere. It's fantastic.
And Sarah, Kevin mentioned volunteering at museums. That's a way to take the next step. If you've already been there and you're really into it, do most museums offer volunteer opportunities?
Nearly all of them, and some of them are fully staffed by volunteers.
Really?
So anything you want to do, from collections work to being a greeter or helping in a gift shop, absolutely step into your favorite museum and sign up.
All right, we'll go back to our callers now. Thanks, Kevin, by the way. We'll go to Paula now in Beloit. Paula, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Good. What's your museum?
Well, I love so many different museums in the state, but one of the favorites I have is the Potosi Brewing Museum. And it's over on the edge of the state near Iowa. And it has a wonderfully restored brewery, working brewery. I mean, you can get Potosi beer all over the place, but they've got a great restaurant, a wonderful tour, beer tastings, and they've really done a great job restoring a gorgeous historic building.
Thanks for that suggestion, Paula. And you mentioned, Sarah, I think if the word museum pops into our heads, we might think art museum or natural history museum. And you mentioned there are a lot of corporate museums out there that are worth a visit.
Oh, absolutely. I highly recommend the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee. They have a phenomenal collection, and it's not all about advertising and marketing for the company. It really is Milwaukee history, nitty-gritty.
What kind of stuff do they have?
They have a giant bike collection, as you'd probably expect, including the very first bike off the line. They have all sorts of archival material. They have uniforms, military uniforms, pretty much anything you can imagine. Leather jackets galore.
Oh, that sounds cool, too. All right, well, let's go back to our phone lines and go next to Deborah calling from Brown Deer. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Well, I have to say I absolutely love John Michael Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan, and I love there's amazing things to do there, and it's free. And I love the Kohler Design Center. I know it's not a museum, but it should be. They should have one. And I have been on the Dennis Sullivan, and that's amazing, as your first caller pointed out also.
Well, Deborah, I was just at the Design Center up there in Sheboygan this weekend, and yeah, there's a lot of the modern technology stuff, but in the basement there's that museum. It has replicas of the first tub, the first Kohler sold to a farmer, and engines from history that Kohler has made. So there's definitely a museum angle there, I thought.
Oh, I didn't know that. I don't know if that...
Maybe that's new.
That must be fairly new within the past, 10 years?
Yeah, it's so that's definitely worth a visit, too. Thank you so much for suggesting those museums. And we'll continue our conversation about Wisconsin Museum Week. We've got Sarah Kapelisch with us. She's registrar at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum and vice president of the Wisconsin Federation of Museums.
And we'd love to hear from you on this one. What is your favorite museum in Wisconsin? You can tell us a memory, one that you revisit again, maybe as a child and now with your family. And, you know, is there a museum you'd like to see in Wisconsin that you'd like to create? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with Sarah Kapelisch, registrar at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum and vice president of the Wisconsin Federation of Museums. We're observing Museum Week right now. It's Wisconsin Museum Week, so we're celebrating and hearing from you.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite museum in Wisconsin? Or maybe one that's off the beaten path that you think more people should discover? The number is 800-642-1234, or you could post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we will go next to Emily, who is joining us in Cable. Hi, Emily.
Hi. My favorite museum is the Cable Natural History Museum up in the northwest corner of the state. And they just opened a new exhibit called Nature Superheroes, Adventures with Adaptations.
That sounds pretty cool. So what do you expect to see there?
They have comic pages from like a comic book blown up to huge size, outlining the adventures of several animals that have superhero powers. And there's interactive stuff. There's a cargo net shaped like a spider web that you can jump on, and a green screen set up where you can actually pretend to fly through the North Woods.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. You know, that surprises me because I've been to Cable several times over the years, probably at least 10 times, and I've never heard of that museum. So I guess that gets at how many there are in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for telling us about it. And Sarah, do you know much about that one?
No, but it sounds super fun.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that one. You can share your favorite museum at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Richard in Madison. Richard, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say my favorite museum, the Horde Museum, Horde Deering Museum in Port Atkinson. They've got great displays, you know, running through the history of dairy production in Wisconsin. They've got, you know, then there's a regular museum part where they've got art, and they've got a Lincoln section, you know, with his connections to Wisconsin and everything. It's Went there a lot as a kid. Like, if you go there over 4th of July, over there, you know, the weekend, they have, like, an ice cream social and stuff there. It's just a really nice little museum.
Nice. And you say it's pretty kid-friendly, too, Richard.
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so. There's a lot of interactive displays in, like, the dairy section. And my son, when we lived in Fort Atkinson, took him there a few times, and he loved it.
That's great. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Richard. So a dairy museum, that, Sarah, seems like a natural for the state.
Oh, absolutely. Great idea. And I like the idea of the ice cream social.
Lovely. And let's go on next to Blake. Blake joins us from Black River Falls. Hi there.
Hi there. How are you today?
Doing good. What is your vote for favorite museum?
Well, you know, what I really appreciate, and of course I appreciate all the larger museums in the state, they're fascinating. But I also appreciate the smaller community ones. For instance, I used to live in Elroy years ago, and Elroy has a historical museum which tells about the community itself. And what's amazing is at one time 60 trains came through Elroy in one day. And
wow.
There's a lot of wonderful history in those smaller communities throughout the entire state.
Right, agreed. Well, thank you so much for drawing our attention to some of these smaller museums. And the Cable Museum may be another example. What about some hidden gems that show up in smaller towns, Sarah?
Oh, all sorts of them. The Racine has a small history museum that just talks about industry in Racine County. Actually, most small towns have a little bit of a museum, and they're so important because they're really a hub for the community, and they just bring people together.
Well, I think of all the times I've driven past the sign that says Local History Museum for whatever community and think, oh, I should check that out and never get around to it. And then I've moved on from the town. I'm kind of kicking myself now. There's got to be a lot of good stuff at those that I've missed by skipping those.
Yeah, and definitely do what you can to support your small museums because those are the ones that really struggle. But in many ways, they're the ones that do the most for us as a society.
And Rob, I think there's probably a lot of museums in your future. Don't be too downhearted.
Oh, yeah, but
lots of highway ahead. We can still do that. All right, let's go next to Tina. Tina joining us from, is it Kenosha or, Kashina? Hi there,
yes.
Tina.
Hi.
Sorry about your pronunciation there. What is your favorite museum?
The Menominee Logging Camp Museum in Kashina, Wisconsin.
What kind of stuff do they have there?
They have old from the old logging days in Northern Wisconsin. They just have the old logging, I guess the big saws. They have an old camp set up.
Wow. And do they have some of the stories? I hear those are pretty rough times in some of those logging camps.
Yes, they do have stories. There's, you know, they kind of have it set up the way it was back in the early 1900s. They have a lot of the machinery they used. And the mess hall.
And Tina, where is Kashina?
It is about 45 minutes northwest of Green Bay.
Okay, gotcha. Great. It's always good to hear about a new area and a new museum. Thank you so much for that. And there's got to be other logging museums in Wisconsin, I would think, because it's such a logging state in the Northwoods and all that. But it's good to hear about this one. And let's move on next to Richard. Richard in Spooner. Hi there.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My favorite museum is, it's actually a museum and park. It's called Fort Fallavon Historic Park. It's in Burnett County near Danbury, Wisconsin, real close to the Minnesota-Wisconsin border. And it's an actual archaeological reconstruction of two early 1800 fur trade posts that were competing, the Northwest Company and the XY Company. It's also got a Indian village, reconstructed Chippewa village, that has first and third person interpretation. So it's kind of a hands-on park. And then it's got an old lodge that was relocated from northern Minnesota, Snowbank Lodge. That's an interpretive center and a museum, which has the site's collection. Also has a restaurant that serves period food and a gift and bookshop. So it's pretty neat place. They're open year-round. They do all kinds of special events. It's pretty special.
That's
kind of out in the middle of nowhere. So.
Fascinating.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. I think we need a Central Time field trip to that one.
We do. We need a museum tour.
Yeah, that would be really cool. Well, thank you so much. I had no idea about that. And that is in Spooner. Thank you so much, Richard, for that call.
And let's get to Todd now in Woodruff. Todd, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My favorite museum is the Dr. Kate Museum in Woodruff.
And Dr. Kate was a physician back many years ago that for decades went around and made house calls on snowshoes and skis and whatever else was necessary in snowstorms and any other weather to provide medical care to people in the area. And we're very rich in logging and railroad history. And about a mile away in the town of Minocqua, we also have the Minocqua Museum, which is full of a lot of the history, too. So there's a lot of things right in the immediate area as far as museums go.
Todd, thanks so much. Sarah, you could just plan a vacation around museums. You could just pick a region of the state and do a museum tour.
Oh, absolutely.
Are there some that are still on your list that you, I mean, obviously 350 museums, you haven't been to all of them, but are there some that you're dying to get to?
I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I have not been to Old World, Wisconsin, which is practically in my backyard. And like one of the previous callers said, it's so fun to have that interaction and to kind of just be placed back in history. So I'd really like to go there soon.
Yeah, it's that immersion experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to another caller. Dina in Hazel Green. Hi, Dina.
Hi, good afternoon. Speaking of Old World, Wisconsin, there's a Wisconsin author who's done some murder mysteries based on a Old World, Wisconsin curator, and they're very interesting looking at the historical aspects of Wisconsin. But on to museums, the Rollo Jamison Mining Museum in Platteville, because we haven't talked about mining. And then in Peshtigo, I really enjoyed the Peshtigo Museum that talked about the Peshtigo fire. I had absolutely no idea that fire killed more people than the one that took place in Chicago. And I would never have known that if not going to that museum. So those are my thoughts.
Couple of great suggestions. Yeah, they can really, I mean, the museum sometimes can be the bridge that really brings history home. I guess that's what they do when they're really doing their best. And that's a great idea.
We're just about out of time. I want to share. Eric on Facebook recommends the Mid-Continent Railway Museum. John on Facebook recommends the Charles Alice Art Museum and the Villa Terrace Decorative Arts Museum in Milwaukee. Hidden gems, he says. Fabulous collections. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of the great museums around the state on Museum Week.
Thanks for having me, and get out and do some museuming this week.
We've been talking about Wisconsin museums with Sarah Capella. She's registrar at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, and she's vice president of the Wisconsin Federation of Museums.